Side 4. A Fire Upon the Deep by Werner Venge. Continuing on page 73. Peregrine let Scriber Jacques Ramafan do the talking. Scriber loved it. He told the story of the flying house, of the ambush and the murders, and the rescue. He showed them his eye tools and announced himself as a secret agent of the Long Lakes Republic. Now what real spy would do that? Every pack on the council had eyes on the alien, some fearful, some, like Scrupolo, crazily curious. Woodcarver watched with only a couple of heads. The rest might have been asleep. She looked as tired as Peregrine felt. He rested his own heads on his paws. The pain and scar was a pulsing beat. It would be easy enough to set the member asleep, but then he'd understand very little of what was being said. Hey, maybe that wasn't such a bad idea. Scar drifted off, and the pain receded. The talk went on for some minutes more, not making a whole lot of sense to the threesome that was Wickrack. He understood the tones of voice, though. Scrupolo, the pack on the floor, complained several times, impatiently. Vendacious said something agreeing with him. The doctor retreated, and Scrupolo advanced on Wickrack's alien. Peregrine pulled himself to full wakefulness.
"Be careful. The creature is not friendly."
Scrupolo snapped back.
"Your friend has already warned me once."
He circled the litter, staring at the alien's brown, furless face. The alien stared back, impassive. Scrupolo reached forward cautiously and drew back the alien's quilt. Still no response.
"See," said Scrupolo. "It knows I mean no harm."
Peregrine said nothing to correct him.
"It really walks on those rear paws alone," said one of the other advisers. "Can you imagine it, towering over us? One little bump would knock it down."
Laughter. Peregrine remembered how mantis-like the alien had seemed when upright. Scrupolo wrinkled a nose.
"The thing is filthy."
He was all around her, a posture that Peregrine knew upset the two legs.
"That arrow shaft must be removed, you know. Most of the bleeding has stopped, but if we expect the creature to live for long, it needs medical attention."
He looked disdainfully at Scriber and Peregrine, as if they were to blame for not performing surgery aboard the Twin Hull. Something caught his eye, and his tone abruptly changed.
"By the pack of packs! Look at its forepaws!"
He loosened the ropes about the creature's front legs.
"Two paws like that would be as good as five pairs of lips. Think what a pack of these creatures could do."
He moved close to the five-tentacled paw.
"Beep!"
"Careful," Peregrine started to say. The alien abruptly bunched its tentacles into a club. Its foreleg flicked out at an impossible angle, ramming its paw into Scrupolo's head. The blow couldn't have been too strong, but it was precisely placed on the tympanum.
"Ow! Yow! Wow! Wow!"
Scrupolo danced back. The alien was shouting, too. It was all mouth noise, thin and low-pitched. The eldritch sound brought up all heads, even woodcarvers. Peregrine had heard it many times by now. There was no doubt in his mind this was the alien's enterpack speech. After a few seconds, the sound changed to a regular hacking that gradually faded. For a long moment, no one spoke. Then part of Woodcarver got to her feet. She looked at Scrupolo.
"Are you all right?"
It was the first time she had spoken since the beginning of the meeting. Scrupolo was licking his forehead.
"Yes, it smarts is all."
"Your curiosity will kill you some day."
The other huffed indignantly, but also seemed flattered by the prediction. Queen Woodcarver looked at her counselors.
"I see an important question here. Scrupolo thinks one alien member would be as agile as an entire pack of us. Is that so?"
She pointed the question at Peregrine rather than Scriber.
"Yes, Your Majesty. If those ropes had been tied within its reach, it could easily have unknotted them."
He knew where this was going. He'd had 3 days to get there himself.
"And the noises it makes sound like coordinated speech to me."
There was a swell of talk as the others caught on. An articulate member can often make semi-sensible speech, but usually at the expense of dexterity.
Yes. A creature like nothing on our world, whose boat flew down from the top of heaven. I wonder at the mind of such a pack, if a single member is almost as smart as all of one of us.
Her blind one looked around as it made the words, almost as if it could see. Two others wiped at her drooler's muzzle. She was not an inspiring sight. Scrupolo poked a head up.
I hear not a hint of thought sound from this one. There is no for tympanum.
He pointed at the torn clothing around the creature's wound.
And I see no sign of shoulder tympana. Perhaps it is pack smart, even as a singleton. And perhaps that's all the aliens ever are.
Peregrine smiled to himself. The Scrupolo was a prickly twit, but not one who held with tradition. For centuries, academics had debated the difference between people and animals. Some animals had larger brains. Some had paws or lips more agile than a member's. In the savannas of Easterly, there were creatures that even looked like people and ran in groups, but without much depth of thought. Leaving aside wolf nests and whales, only people were packs. It was the coordination of thought between members that made them superior. Scrupolo's theory was a heresy. Jacques Ramathan said,
But we did hear thought sounds, loud ones, during the ambush. Perhaps this one is like our unweaned, unable to think.
And yet still almost as smart as a pack, Woodcarver finished somberly. If these people are not smarter than we might learn their devices. No matter how magnificent they are, we could eventually be their equals. But if this member is just one of a super pack...
For a moment there was no talk, just the muted underedge of her counselor's thoughts. If the aliens were super packs, and if their envoy had been murdered, then there might not be anything they could do to save themselves.
So, our first priority should be to save this creature, to befriend it and learn its true nature.
Her head's lowered, and she seemed lost within herself, or perhaps just tired. Abruptly, she turned several heads toward her chamberlain.
Move the creature to the lodge by mine.
Vendacious started with surprise.
Surely not, Your Majesty. We've seen that it is hostile, and it needs medical attention.
Woodcarver smiled, and her voice turned silky. Peregrine remembered that tone from before.
Do you forget that I know surgery? Do you forget that I am the woodcarver?
Vendacious licked his lips and looked at the other advisers. After a second, he said,
No, Your Majesty, it will be as you wish.
And Peregrine felt like cheering. Perhaps Woodcarver did still run things. Chapter 12. Peregrine was sitting back to back on the steps of his quarters when Woodcarver came to see him next day. She came alone, wearing the simple green jackets he remembered from his last visit. He didn't bow or go out to meet her. She looked at him coolly for a moment and sat down just a few yards away.
How is the two legs? He asked.
I took out the arrow and sewed the wound shut. I think it will survive. My advisers were pleased. The creature didn't act like a reasoning being. It fought even after it was tied down as though it had no concept of surgery. How is your head?
All right, as long as I don't move around.
The rest of them, Scar, lay behind the doorway in the dark interior of the lodge.
The tympanum is healing straight, I think. I'll be fine in a few days.
Good.
A wrecked tympanum could mean continuing mental problems or the need for a new member and the pain of finding a use for the singleton that was sent into silence.
I remember you, Pilgrim. All the members are different, but you really are the Peregrine of before. You had some great stories. I enjoyed your visit.
And I enjoyed meeting the great woodcarver. That is the reason I returned.
She cocked a head wryly.
The great woodcarver of before, not the wreck of now?
He shrugged.
What happened?
She didn't answer immediately. For a moment they sat and looked across the city. It was cloudy this afternoon, with rain coming.
The breeze off the channel was a cool stinging on his lips and eyes. Woodcarver shivered and puffed her fur out a bit. Finally, she said, "I held my soul 600 years, and that's counting by foreclaws. I should think it's obvious what has become of me."
"The perversion never hurt you before."
Peregrine was not normally so blunt. Something about her brought out the frankness in him. "Yes, the average incest degrades to my state in a few centuries, and is an idiot long before then. My methods were much cleverer. I knew who to breed with whom, which puppies to keep and which to put on others. So it was always my flesh bearing my memories, and my soul remained pure. But I didn't understand enough, or perhaps I tried the impossible. The choices got harder and harder, till I was left with choosing between brains and physical defect." She wiped away the drool, and all but the blind one looked out across her city. "These are the best days of summer, you know. Life is a green madness just now, trying to squeeze the last bit of warmth from the season." And the green did seem to be everywhere it could be. Featherleaf down the hillside and in the town, ferns all over the near hillsides, and heather struggling toward the gray crowns of the mountains across the channel. "I love this place." He never expected to be comforting the woodcarver of woodcarvers.
"You made a miracle here. I've heard of it all the way on the other side of the world, and I'll bet that half the packs around here are related to you."
Yes. I've been successful beyond a rake's wildest dreams. I've had no shortage of lovers, even if I couldn't use the pups myself. Sometimes I think my get has been my greatest experiment. Scrupulo and Vendacious are mostly my offspring, but so is Flenser.
Huh?
Peregrine hadn't known that last. "The last few decades, I'd more or less accepted my fate. I couldn't outwit eternity. Sometime soon, I would let my soul slip free. I let the council take over more and more. How could I claim the domain after I was no longer me? I went back to art. You saw those monochrome mosaics."
"Yes, they're beautiful."
"I'll show you my picture loom sometime. The procedure is tedious, but almost automatic. It was a nice project for the last years of my soul. But now, you and your alien have changed everything."
"Damn it! If only this had happened 100 years ago, what I would have done with it!"
"We've been playing with your picture box, you know. The pictures are finer than any in our world. They are a bit like my mosaics, the way the sun is like a glow bug.
Millions of colored dots go to make each picture, the tiles so small you can't see them without one of Scriber's lenses. I've worked for years to make a few dozen mosaics. The picture box can make unnumbered thousands, so fast they seem to move. Your aliens make my life less than an unweaned pup's scratching in its cradle." The queen of the woodcarvers was softly crying, but her voice was angry. "And now the whole world is going to change, but too late for such wreckage as I." Almost without conscious thought, Peregrine extended one of his members toward the woodcarver. He walked unseemly close, 8 yards, 5. Their thoughts were suddenly fuzzy with interference, but he could feel her calming. She laughed blearily. "Thank you. Strange that you should be sympathetic. The greatest problem of my life is nothing to a pilgrim."
"You were hurting."
It was all he could think to say. "But you pilgrims change and change and change." She eased one of herself close to him. They were almost touching, and it was even harder to think. Peregrine spoke slowly, concentrating on every word, hoping he wouldn't forget his point.
"But I do keep something of a soul. The parts that remain a pilgrim must have a certain outlook."
"Sometimes great insight comes in the noise of battle or intimacy. This was such a time."
And I think the world itself is due for a change of soul,
Now that we have two legs dropping from the sky, what better time for woodcarver to give up the old? She smiled, and the confusion became louder, but a pleasant thing.
I hadn't thought of it that way. Now is the time to change.
Peregrine walked into her midst. The two packs stood for a moment, necking, thoughts blending into sweet chaos. Their last clear recollection was of stumbling up the steps and into his lodge. Late that afternoon, Woodcarver brought the picture box to Scrupolo's laboratory. When she arrived, Scrupolo and Vendacious were already present.
Scriber Jacques Ramafan was there too, but standing farther from the others than courtesy might demand.
She had interrupted some kind of argument. A few days before, such squabbling would have just depressed her. Now she dragged her limper into the room and looked at the others through her drooler's eyes and smiled. Woodcarver felt the best she had in years. She had made her decision and acted on it, and now there were new adventures to be had. Scriber brightened at her entrance.
Did you check on Peregrine? How is he?
He is fine, fine, just fine.
Oops, no need to show them how fine he really is.
I mean, there'll be a full recovery.
Your Majesty, I am very grateful to you and your doctors. Wick Rackscar is a good pack, and I mean, even a pilgrim can't change members every day like suits of clothes.
Woodcarver waved an offhand acknowledgment. She walked to the middle of the room and set the alien's picture box on the table there. It looked like nothing so much as a big pink pillow with floppy ears and a weird animal design sewed in its cover. After playing with it for a day and a half, she was getting pretty good at opening the thing up. As always, the two legs' face appeared, making mouth noises. As always, Woodcarver felt an instant of awe at seeing the moving mosaic. A million colored tiles had to flip and shift in absolute synchrony to create the illusion. Yet it happened exactly the same each time. She turned the screen so Scrupolo and Vendacious could see. Jacques Ramafan edged toward the others and craned a pair of heads to look.
You still think the box is an animal? He said to Vendacious. Perhaps you could feed it sweets and it would tell us its secrets, eh?
Woodcarver smiled to herself. Scriber was no pilgrim. Pilgrims depend on goodwill too much to go around giving the needle to the powerful. Vendacious just ignored him. All his eyes were on her.
Your Majesty, please do not take offense. We of the Council, must ask you again. This picture box is too important to be left in the mouths of a single pack, even one so great as you. Please, leave it to the rest of us. At least when you sleep.
No offense taken. If you insist, you may participate in my investigations. Beyond that, I will not go.
She gave him an innocent look. Vendacious was a superb spymaster, a mediocre administrator, and an incompetent scientist. A century ago, she would have had the likes of him out tending the crops, if he chose to stay at all. A century ago, there had been no need for spy masters, and one administrator had been enough. How things had changed! She absent-mindedly nuzzled the picture box. Perhaps things would change again. Scrupolo took Scriber's question seriously.
I see three possibilities, sir. First, that it is magic.
Vendacious winced away from him.
Indeed, the box may be so far beyond our understanding that it is magic. But that is the one heresy the woodcarver has never accepted, and so I courteously omit it.
He flicked a sardonic smile at Woodcarver.
Second, that it is an animal. A few on the council thought so when Scriber first made it talk, but it looks like a stuffed pillow, even down to the amusing figure stitched on its side. More importantly, it responds to stimuli with perfect repeatability. That is something I do recognize. That is the behavior of a machine.
That's your third possibility, said Scriber.
But to be a machine means to have moving parts and except for...
Woodcarver shrugged a tail at them.
Scrupolo could go on like this for hours, and she saw that Scriber was the same type.
I say, let's learn more and then speculate.
She tapped the corner of the box just as Scriber had in his original demonstration. The alien's face vanished from the picture, replaced by a dizzying pattern of color. There was a splatter of sound, then nothing but the mid-pitch hum the box always made when the top was open. They knew the box could hear low-pitched sounds, and it could feel through the square pad on its base. But that pad was itself a kind of picture screen. Certain commands transformed the grid of touch spots into entirely new shapes. The first time they did that, the box refused any further commands. Vendacious had been sure they had killed the little alien, but they had closed the box and reopened it, and it was back to its original behavior. Woodcarver was almost certain that nothing they could do by talking to it or touching it would hurt the thing. Woodcarver retried the known signals in the usual order. The results were spectacular and identical to before. But change that order in any way, and the effects would be different. She wasn't sure if she agreed with Scrupolo. The box behaved with the repeatability of a machine, yet the variety of its responses was much more like an animal's. Behind her, Scriber and Scrupolo edged members across the floor. Their heads were stuck high in the air as they strained for a clear look at the screen. The buzz of their thoughts came louder and louder. Woodcarver tried to remember what she'd been planning next. Finally, the noise was just too much. "Will you two please back off? I can't hear myself think. This isn't a choir, you know." "Sorry. This okay?" They moved back about 15 feet. Woodcarver nodded. The two members were less than 20 feet from each other. Scrupolo and Scriber must be really eager to see the screen. Vendacious had kept a proper distance and a look of alert enthusiasm.
"I have a suggestion," said Scriber.
His voice was slurred from the effort of concentrating over Scrupolo's thoughts.
"When you touch the 4-3 square and say..." He made the alien sounds. They were all very easy to do. "The screen shows a collection of pictures. They seem to match the squares. I think we are being given choices."
The box could end up training us?
If this is a machine, we need some new definitions.
Very well. Let's play with it.
3 hours passed. Toward the end, even Vendacious had moved a member nearer the screen. The noise in the room verged on mindless chaos, and everybody had suggestions. "Say that. Press this. Last time it said that. We did thus and so." There were intricate colored designs, sprinkled with things that must have been written language. Tiny two-legged figures scampered across the screen, shifting the symbols, opening little windows. Scriber Jacques Ramafan's idea was quite right. The first pictures were choices, but some of those led to further pictures of choices. "The options spread out, tree-like," Scriber said. He wasn't quite right. Sometimes they came back to an earlier point. It was a metaphorical network of streets. 4 times they ended in cul-de-sacs and had to shut the box and begin again. Vendacious was madly drawing maps of the paths. That would help. There were places they would want to see again. But even he realized there were unnumbered other paths, places that blind exploration would never find. And Woodcarver would have given a good part of her soul for the pictures she had already seen. There were starscapes. There were moons that shone blue and green or banded orange. There were moving pictures of alien cities, of thousands of aliens so close that they were actually touching. If they ran in packs, those packs were bigger than anything in the world, even in the tropics. And maybe the question was irrelevant. The cities were beyond anything she ever imagined. Finally, Jacques Ramafan backed off. He huddled together. There was a shiver in his voice.
There's a whole universe in there. We could follow it forever and never know.
She looked at the other two. For once, Vendacious had lost his smugness. There were ink stains on all his lips. The writing benches around him were littered with dozens of sketches, some clearer than others. He dropped the pen and gasped. I say we take what we have and study it.
He began gathering the sketches, piling them into a neat stack. Tomorrow, after a good sleep, our heads will be clear and...
Scrupolo dropped back and stretched. His eyes had excited red rims.
Fine, but leave the sketches, friend Vendacious.
He jabbed at the drawings.
See that one and that? It's clear that our blundering gets us plenty of empty results. Sometimes the picture box just locks us out, but much more often we get that picture. No options, just a couple of aliens dancing in a forest and making rhythm sounds. Then if we say...
And he repeated part of the sequence.
We get that picture of piles of sticks. The first with one, the second with two, and so on.
Woodcarver saw it too.
Yes, and a figure comes out and points to each of the piles and says a short noise by each.
She and Scrupolo stared at each other, each seeing the same gleam in the other's eyes, the excitement of learning, of finding order where there had seemed only chaos. It had been 100 years since she last felt this way.
Whatever this thing is, it's trying to teach us the two legs' language.
In the days that followed, Johanna Olschendott had lots of time to think. The pain in her chest and shoulder gradually eased. If she moved carefully, it was only a pulsing soreness. They had taken the arrow out and sewed the wound closed. She had feared the worst when they had tied her down, when she saw the knives in their mouths and the steel on their claws. Then they began cutting. She had not known there could be such pain. She still shuddered with remembered agony, but she didn't have nightmares about it, the way she did about... Mother and Dad were dead. She had seen them die with her own eyes. And Geoffrey? Geoffrey might still be alive. Sometimes Johanna could go a whole afternoon full of hope. She had seen the cold sleepers burning on the ground below the ship, but those inside might have survived. Then she would remember the indiscriminate way the attackers had flamed and slashed, killing everything around the ship. She was a prisoner, but for now the murderers wanted her well. The guards were not armed, beyond their teeth and tines. They kept well away from her when they could. They knew she could hurt them. They kept her inside a big, dark cabin. When she was alone, she paced the floor. The dog things were barbarians. The surgery without anesthetics was probably not even intended as torture. She hadn't seen any aircraft or any sign of electricity. The toilet was a slot carved in a marble slab. The hole went so deep you could scarcely hear the plop hit bottom. But it still smelled bad.
These creatures were as backward as people in the darkest ages on New Yora.
They had never had technology, or they had thoroughly forgotten it. Johanna almost smiled. Mom had liked novels about shipwrecks and heroines marooned on lost colonies. The big deal was usually to reinvent technology and repair the spacecraft. Mom was, had been, so into the history of science. She loved the details of those stories. Well, Johanna was living it now, but with important differences. She wanted rescue, but she also wanted revenge. These creatures were nothing like human. In fact, she couldn't remember reading of anything quite like them. She'd have looked for them in her data set, except they had taken that. Ha! Let them play with it. They'd quickly run into her booby traps and find themselves totally locked out. At first, there were only blankets to keep warm. Then they'd given her clothes cut like her jumpsuit, but made of puffy quilting. They were warm and sturdy, the stitching neater than anything she imagined a non-machine could do. Now she could comfortably walk around outside. The garden beyond her cabin was the best thing about the place. It was about 100 meters square and followed the slope of a hillside. There were lots of flowers and trees with long, feathery leaves. Flagstoned walks curved back and forth through mossy turf. It was a peaceful place, if she let it be one, a little like their backyard on Straum. There were walls, but from the high end of the garden she could see over them. The walls angled this way and that, and in places she could see their other side.
The window slits were like something out of her history lessons. They let you fire arrows or bullets without making a target of yourself. When the sun was out, Johanna liked to sit where the smell of the feather leaves was strongest and look over the lower walls at the bay. She still wasn't sure just what she was seeing. There was a harbor. The forest of spars was almost like the marinas on Straum. The town had wide streets, but they zigged and zagged, and the buildings along them were all askew. In places, there were open-roofed mazes of stone. From up here, she could see the pattern. And there was another wall, a rambling thing that ran for as far as she could see. The hills beyond were crowned with gray rock and patches of snow. She could see the dog things down in the town. Individually, you could almost mistake them for dogs, snake-necked, rat-headed ones. But watch them from a distance, and you saw their true nature. They always moved in small groups, rarely more than six. Within the pack, they touched, cooperated with clever grace, but she never saw one group come closer than about 10 meters to another. From her distant viewpoint, the members of a pack seemed to merge, and she could imagine she was seeing one multi-limbed beast ambling cautiously along, careful not to come too close to a similar monster. By now, the conclusion was inescapable. One pack, one mind. Minds so evil they could not bear to be close to one another. Her fifth time in the garden was the prettiest yet, a coercion toward joy. The flowers had sprayed downy seeds into the air. The lowering sunlight sparkled off them as they floated by the thousands on the slow breeze, clots in an invisible syrup. She imagined what Jeffrey would do here. First pretend grown-up dignity, then bounce from one foot to the other. Finally, he would race down the hillside, trying to capture as many of the flying tufts as he could, laughing and laughing. "One, two, how do you do?" It was a child's voice behind her. Johanna jumped up so fast she almost tore her stitches. Sure enough, there was a pack behind her. It was the one who had cut the arrow out of her. A mangy lot. The five were crouched, ready to run away. They looked almost as surprised as Johanna felt. "One, two, how do you do?" The voice came again, exactly as before. It might as well have been a recording, except that one of the animals was somehow synthesizing the sound with the buzzing patches of skin on its shoulders, haunches, and head. The parrot act was nothing new to her, but this time the words were almost appropriate. The voice was not hers, but she had heard that chant before. She put hands on hips and stared at the pack. Two of the animals stared back. The others seemed to be admiring the scenery. One licked nervously at its paw. The two rear ones were carrying her data set. Suddenly she knew where they'd gotten that sing-song question, and she knew what they expected in response. "I am fine, and how do you do?" she said. The pack's eyes widened almost comically. "I am fine, so then are we all." It completed the game, then emitted a burst of gobbling. Someone replied from down the hill. There was another pack there, lurking in the bushes. She knew that if she stayed near this one, the other wouldn't approach. So the Tynes, she always thought of them by those claws on their front feet, those she would never forget, had been playing with a pink olifant, and hadn't been stopped by the booby traps. That was better than Jeffrey ever managed. It was clear they had fallen into the kinder mode language programs. She should have thought of that. When the data set noted sufficiently asinine responses, it would adapt its behavior, first for young children, and, if that didn't work, for youngsters who didn't even speak Sannorsch. With just a little cooperation from Johanna, they could learn her language. Did she want that? The pack walked a little nearer, at least two of them watching her all the time. They didn't seem quite so ready to bolt as before. The nearest one dropped to its belly and looked up at her. Very cute and helpless, if you didn't see the claws. "My name is..." Johanna heard a short burst of gobble with an overtone that seemed to buzz right through her head. "What is your name?" Johanna knew it was all part of the language script.
There was no way the creature could understand the individual words it was saying. That "my name, your name" pair was repeated over and over again between the children in the language program. A vegetable would get the point eventually. Still, the Tyne's pronunciation was so perfect.
"My name is Johanna," she said.
"Johanna,"
said the pack, with Johanna's voice, and splitting the word stream incorrectly.
"Johanna,"
corrected Johanna. She wasn't even going to try saying the Tyne's name.
"Hello, Johanna. Let's play the naming game."
And that was from the script, too, complete with silly enthusiasm. Johanna sat down. Sure, learning Samnorsk would give the Tynes power over her, but it was the only way she could learn about them, the only way she could learn about Yefri. And if they had murdered Yefri, too, well, then, she would learn to hurt them as much as they deserved.
Chapter 13. At Woodcarver's, and then, a few days later, at Flenser's Hidden Island, the long daylight of Arctic summer ended. At first there was a little twilight just around midnight, when even the highest hills stood in shadow. And then the hours of dark grew quickly. Day fought night, and night was winning. The feather leaf in the low valleys changed to autumn colors. Looking up a fjord in daylight was to see orange-red on the lower hills, then the green of heather merging imperceptibly to the grays of lichen and the darker grays of naked rock. The snow patches waited for their time. It would come soon. At every sunset, each day a few minutes earlier, Tyrethecht toured the ramparts of Flenser's outer wall. It was a 3-mile walk. The lower levels were guarded by linear packs, but up here there were only a few lookouts. When she approached, they stepped aside with military precision. More than military precision, she saw the fear in their look. It was hard to get used to that. For almost as far back as she had clear memories, 20 years, Tyrethecht had lived in fear of others, in shame and guilt, in search of someone to follow. Now all that was turned on its head. It was not an improvement. She knew now, from the inside, the evil she had given herself to. She knew why the sentries feared her. To them, she was Flenser. Of course, she never gave any hint of these thoughts. Her life was only as safe as the success of her fraud. Tyrethecht had worked hard to suppress her natural, shy mannerisms. Not once since coming to Hidden Island had she caught herself in the old bashful habit of heads lowering, eyes closing. Instead, Tyrethecht had the Flenser stare, and she used it. Her passage around the top wall was as stark and ominous as Flenser's had ever been. She looked out over his domain with the same hard gaze as before, all heads front, as if seeing visions beyond the petty minds of the disciples. They must never guess her real reason for these sunset sweeps. For a time, the days and nights were like in the Republic. She could almost imagine she was still back there, before the movement and the massacre at Parliament Bowl, before they cut her throats and wed pieces of Flenser to the stumps of her soul. In the gold and russet fields beyond the stone curtains, she could see peasants trimming the fields and the herds. Flenser ruled lands far beyond her view, but he had never imported food. The grain and meat that filled the storehouses were all produced within a 2 days' march of the straits. The strategic intent was clear. Still, it made for a peaceful evening's view and brought back memories of her home and school. The sun slid sideways into the mountains. Long shadows swept the farmlands. Flenser's castle was left an island in a sea of shadow. Tyrethecht could smell the cold. There would be frost again tonight. Tomorrow the fields would be covered with false snow. That would last an hour past sunrise. She pulled the long jackets close around her and walked to the eastern lookout. Across the straits, one of the near hilltops was still in the sun. The alien ship had landed there. It was still there, but now behind wood and stone. Steel began building there right after the landing. The quarries at the north end of Hidden Island were busier now than ever in Flenser's time.
The barges hauling stone to the mainland made a steady traffic across the straits. Even now that the light was not day-round, Steele's construction went on non-stop. His end callings and lesser inspections were harsher than Flint's had been. Lord Steele was a killer. Worse, a manipulator. But since the alien landing, Tyrethect knew that he was something else, deathly afraid. He had good reason, and even though the folk he feared might ultimately kill them all, in her secret soul she wished them well. Steele and his Flenserists had attacked the Star people without warning, more out of greed than fear. They had killed dozens of beings. In a way, the murders were worse than what the movement had done to her. Tyrethect had followed the Flenser of her own free will. She had had friends who warned her about the movement. There had been dark stories about the Flenser, and not all had been government propaganda. But she had so wanted to follow, to give herself to something greater. They had used her literally as their tool. Yet she could have avoided it. The Star people had had no such option. Steele simply butchered them. So now Steele labored out of fear. In the first 3 days he had covered the flying ship with a roof. A sudden, silly farmhouse had appeared on the hilltop. Before long, the alien craft would be hidden behind stone walls. Ultimately, the new fortress might be bigger than the one on Hidden Island. Steele knew that if his villainy did not destroy him, it would make him the most powerful pack in the world. And that was Tyrethect's reason for staying, for continuing her masquerade. She couldn't go on forever. Sooner or later, the other fragments would reach Hidden Island. Tyrethect would be destroyed, and all of Flenser would live again. Perhaps she wouldn't survive even that long. Two of Tyrethect were of Flenser. The Master had miscalculated in thinking they could dominate the other three. Instead, the conscience of the three had come to own the brilliance of the two. She remembered almost everything the great Flenser had known, all the tricks and all the betrayals. The two had given her an intensity she had never had before. Tyrethect laughed to herself. In a sense, she had gained what she had been so naively seeking in the movement. And the great Flenser had made exactly the mistake that, in his arrogance, he thought impossible. As long as she could keep the two under control, she had a chance. When she was all awake, there wasn't much problem. She still felt herself a she, still remembered her life in the Republic more clearly than the Flenser memories. It was different when she slept. There were nightmares. The memories of torment inflicted suddenly seemed sweet. Sleep time sex should soothe. With her, it was a battle. She awoke sore and cut, as if she had been fighting a rapist. If the two ever broke free, if she ever awoke a he, it would take only a few seconds for the two to denounce the masquerade, only a little longer to kill the three and put the Flenser members aboard a more manageable pack. Yet she stayed. Steele meant to use the aliens and their ship to spread Flenser's nightmare worldwide. But his plan was fragile, with risks on every side. If there was anything she could do to destroy it and the Flenser movement, she would. Across the castle, only the western tower still hung in sunlight. No faces showed at the window slits, but eyes looked out. Steele watched the Flenser fragment, the Flenser in waiting, as it styled itself, on the ramparts below. The fragment was accepted by all the commanders. In fact, they accorded it almost the awe they had given to the full Flenser. In a sense, Flenser had made them all, so it wasn't surprising they felt a chill in the Master's presence. Even Steele felt it. In his shaping, Flenser had forced the aborning Steele to try to kill him. Each time Steele had been caught and his weakest members tortured. Steele knew the conditioning that was there, and that helped him fight it. If anything, he told himself, the Flenser frag was in greater danger because of it. In trying to counter the fear, Steele might just miscalculate and act more violently than was appropriate. Sooner or later, Steele had to decide. If he didn't kill it before the other fragments reached Hidden Island, then all of Flenser would be here again. If two members could dominate Steele's regime, then six would totally erase it. Did he want the master dead? And if he did, was there any surely safe way? Steele's mind flickered lightly all around the issue as he watched the black-frocked pack. Steele was used to playing for high stakes. He had been born playing for them. Fear and death and winning were his whole life, but never had the stakes been as high as now. Flenser had come close to subverting the largest nation on the continent, and had had dreams of ruling the world. Lord Steele looked to the hillside across the straits at the new castle he was building. In Steele's present game, world conquest would follow easily on victory, and the destruction of the world was a conceivable consequence of failure. Steele had visited the flying ship shortly after the ambush. The ground was still steaming. Every hour it seemed to grow hotter. The mainland peasants talked of demons wakened in the earth. Steele's advisors could not do much better. The white jackets needed padded boots to get close. Steele had ignored the steam, donned the boots, and walked beneath the curving hull. The bottom was vaguely like a boat's hull if you ignored the stilts. Near the center was a teat-like projection. The ground directly underneath burbled with molten rock. The burned-out coffins were on the uphill side of the ship. Several of the corpses had been removed for dissection. In the first hours, his advisors had been full of fanciful theories. The Mantis folk were warriors fleeing a battle come to bury their dead. So far, no one had been able to take a careful look inside the craft. The gray stairs were made of something as strong as steel, yet feather-light. But they were recognizably stairs, even if the risers were high for the average member. Steele scrambled up the steps, leaving Shrek and his other advisors outside. He stuck a head through the hatch and jerked back abruptly. The acoustics were deadly. He understood what the white jackets were complaining about. How could the aliens bear it? One by one, he forced himself through the opening. Echoes screamed at him, worse than from unpadded quartz. He quieted himself, as he had so often done in the master's presence. The echoes diminished, but they were still a horde raging in the walls all around. Not even his best white jackets could tolerate more than 5 minutes here. The thought made Steele stand straighter. Discipline. Quiet does not always mean submission. It can mean hunting. He looked around, ignoring the howling murmurs. Light came from bluish strips in the ceiling. As his eyes adjusted, he could see what his people had described to him. The interior was just two rooms. He was standing in the larger one, a cargo hold. There was a hatch in the far wall, and then the second room. The walls were seamless. They met in angles that did not match the outer hull. There would be dead spaces. A breeze moved fitfully about the room, but the air was much warmer than outside. He had never been in a place that felt more of power and evil. Surely it was only a trick of acoustics. They would bring in some absorbent quilts, some side reflectors, and the feeling would go away. Still, the room was filled with coffins, these unburned. The place stank with the alien's body odor. Mold grew in the darker corners. In a way, that was comforting. The aliens breathed and sweated as other living things, and for all their marvelous invention, they could not keep their own den clean. Steele wandered among the coffins. The boxes were mounted on railed racks. When the ones outside had been here, the room must have been crammed full. Undamaged, the coffins were marvels of fine workmanship. Warm air exited slots along the sides. He sniffed at it, complex, faintly nauseating, but not the smell of death, and not the source of the overpowering stench of mantis sweat that hung everywhere. Each coffin had a window mounted on its top side. What effort to honor the remains of single members! Steele hopped onto one and looked down. The corpse was perfectly preserved. In fact, the blue light made everything look frozen. He cocked a second head over the edge of the box, got a double view on the creature within. It was far smaller than the two they had killed under the ship. It was even smaller than the one they had captured. Some of Steele's advisors thought the small ones were pups, perhaps unweaned. It made sense. Their prisoner never made thought sounds. Partly as an act of discipline, he stared for a long while at the alien's queer, flat face. The echo of his mind was a continuing pain, eating at his attention, demanding that he leave. Let the pain continue. He had withstood worse before, and the packs outside must know that Steele was stronger than any of them. He could master the pain and have the greater insight. And then he would work their butts off, quilting these rooms and studying the contents. So Steele stared, almost thoughtless, into the face. The screaming in the walls seemed to fade a little. The face was so ugly. He had looked at the charred corpses outside, noticed their small jaws and randomly misshapen teeth. How could the creature eat? A few minutes passed, the noise and ugliness mixed together, dreamlike. And then, out of his trance, Steele knew a nightmare horror. The face moved. The change was small, and it happened very, very slowly, but over a period of minutes, the face had changed. Steele fell from the coffin. The walls screamed back terror. For a few seconds, he thought the noise would kill him. Then he regained himself with quiet thought. He crawled back onto the box. All his eyes stared through the crystal, waiting like a pack on hunt. The change was regular. The alien in the box was breathing, but 50 times more slowly than any normal member. He moved to another box, watched the creature in it. Somehow, they were all alive. Inside those boxes, their lives were simply slowed. He looked up from the boxes almost in a daze. That the room reeked of evil was an illusion of sound, and also the absolute truth. The mantis alien had landed far from the tropics, away from the collectives. Perhaps it thought the Arctic Northwest a backward wilderness. It had come in a ship jammed with hundreds of mantis pups. These boxes were like larval casings. The pack would land, raise the small ones to adulthood, out of sight of civilization. Steele felt his pelts puff up as he thought about it. If the mantis pack had not been surprised, if Steele's troops had been any less aggressive, it would have been the end of the world. Steele staggered to the outer hatch, his fears coming louder and louder off the walls. Even so, he paused a moment in the shadows and the screams. When his members trooped down the stairs, he moved calmly, every jacket neatly in place. Soon enough, his advisors would know the danger, but they would never see fear in him. He walked lightly across the steaming turf, out from under the hull. But even he could not resist a quick look across the sky. This was one ship, one pack of aliens. It had had the misfortune of running into the movement. Even so, its defeat had been partly luck. How many other ships would land? Had already landed? Was there time for him to learn from this victory? Steele's mind returned to the present, to his eerie lookout above the castle. That first encounter with the ship was many 10 days past. There was still a threat, but now he understood it better, and, as was true of all great threats, it held great promise. On the rampart, Flenser in waiting slid through the deepening twilight. Steele's eyes followed the pack as it walked beneath the torches and one by one disappeared downstairs. There was an awful lot of the master in that fragment. It had understood many things about the alien landing before anyone else. Steele took one last look across the darkening hills as he turned and started down the spiral stair. It was a long, cramped climb. The lookout sat atop a 40-foot tower. The stair was barely 15 inches wide, the ceiling less than 30 inches above the steps. Cold stone pressed in from all around, so close that there were no echoes to confuse thought. Yet also so close that the mind was squeezed into a long thread. Climbing the spiral required a twisting, strung-out posture that left any attacker easy prey for a defender in the eerie. Such was military architecture,
For Steele, crawling the cramped dark was pleasant exercise. The stairs opened onto a public hallway 10 feet across with back-off nooks every 50 feet. Shrek and the bodyguard were waiting for him.
"I have the latest from woodcarvers," said Shrek.
He was holding sheets of silk paper. Losing the other alien to woodcarvers had once seemed a major blow. Only gradually had he realized how well it could work out. He had woodcarvers infiltrated. At first, he'd intended to have the other alien killed. It would have been easy to do. But the information that trickled north was interesting. There were some bright people at woodcarvers. They were coming up with insights that had slipped past Steele and the Master. The fragment of the Master. So, in effect, woodcarvers had become Steele's second alien laboratory, and the movement's enemies were serving him like any other tool. The irony was irresistible.
"Very good, Shrek. Take it to my den. I'll be there shortly."
Steele waved the white jackets into a backup nook and swept past him. Reading the report over Brandy would be a pleasant reward for the day's work. In the meantime, there were other duties and other pleasures. The Master had begun building Hidden Island Castle more than a century earlier. It was growing yet. In the oldest foundations, where an ordinary ruler might put dungeons, were the Flensers' first laboratories. Many could be mistaken for dungeons, and were by their inhabitants. Steele reviewed all the labs at least once a 10-day. Now he swept through the lowest levels. Crickers fled before the light of his guards' torches. There was a smell of rotting meat. Steele's paws skidded where slickness lay upon the stone. Holes were dug in the floor at regular intervals. Each could hold a single member, its legs jammed tight against its body. Each was covered by a lid with tiny air holes. It took the average member about 3 days to go mad in such isolation. The resulting raw material could be used to build blank packs. Generally, they weren't much more than vegetables, but then that was all the movement asked of some. And sometimes remarkable things came from these pits. Shrek, for instance. Shrek the colorless, some called him. Shrek the stolid. A pack who was beyond pain, beyond desire. Shrek's was the loyalty of clockwork, but built from flesh and blood. He was no genius, but Steele would have given an eastern province for 5 more of him. And the promise of more such successes made Steele use the isolation pits again and again. He had recycled most of the wrecks from the ambush that way. Steele climbed back to higher levels where the really interesting experiments were undertaken. The world regarded Hidden Island with fascinated horror. They had heard of the lower levels. But most didn't realize what a small part those dark spaces played in the movement's science. To properly dissect a soul, you need more than benches with blood gutters. The results from the lower levels were simply the first steps in Flenser's intellectual quest. There were great questions in the world, things that had bothered Pax for thousands of years. How do we think? Why do we believe? Why is one pack a genius and another an oaf? Before Flenser, philosophers argued them endlessly and never got closer to the truth. Even Woodcarver had pranced around the issues, unwilling to give up her traditional ethics. Flenser was prepared to get the answers. In these labs, nature itself was under interrogation. Steele walked across a chamber 100 yards wide with a roof supported by dozens of stone pillars. On every side, there were dark partitions, slate walls mounted on tiny wheels. The cavern could be blocked off, maze-like, into any pattern. Flenser had experimented with all the postures of thought. In the centuries before him, there had been only a few effective postures. The instinctive heads together, the ring sentry, various work postures. Flenser had tried dozens more. Stars, double rings, grids. Most were useless and confusing. In the star, only a single member could hear all the others, and each of those could only hear the one. In effect, all thought had to pass through the hub member. The hub could contribute nothing rational, yet all its misconceptions passed uncorrected to the rest. Drunken foolishness resulted.
Of course, that experiment was reported to the outside world. But at least one of the others, still secret, worked strangely well. Flenser posted 8 packs around the floor and on temporary platforms, blocked them from each another with the slate partitions, and then put members from each pack in connection with their counterparts in 3 others. In a sense, he created a pack of 8 packs. Steele was still experimenting with that. If the connectors were sufficiently compatible, and that was the hard part, the resulting creature was far smarter than a ring sentry. In most ways, it was not as bright as a single heads-together pack, yet sometimes it had striking insights. Before he left for the Long Lakes, the master had developed a plan to rebuild the castle's main hall, so council sessions could be conducted in this posture. Steele hadn't pursued that idea. It was just a bit too risky. Steele's domination of others was not quite as complete as Flench's had been. No matter. There were other, more significant projects. The rooms ahead were the true heart of the movement. Steele's soul had been born in these rooms. All of Flencher's greatest creations had begun here. During the last 5 years, Steele had continued the tradition and improved upon it. He walked down the hall that linked the separate suites. Each bore its number in inlaid gold. At each, he opened a door and stepped partway through. His staff left their report on the previous 10 day just inside. Steele quickly read each one, then poked a nose over the balcony to look at the experiment within. The balconies were well padded and screened. It was easy to observe without being seen. Flenser's one weakness, in Steele's opinion, was his desire to create the superior being. The master's confidence was so immense, he believed that any such success could be applied to his own soul. Steele had no such illusions. It was a commonplace that teachers are surpassed by their creations. Pupils, fission children, adoptions, whatever. He, Steele, was a perfect illustration of this, though the master didn't know it yet. Steele had determined to create beings that would each be superior in some single way, while flawed and malleable in others. In the master's absence, he had begun a number of experiments. Steele worked from scratch, identifying inheritance lines independent of pack membership. His agents purchased or stole pups that might have potential. Unlike Flenser, who usually melded pups into existing packs in an approximation of nature, Steele made his totally newborn. His puppy packs had no memories or fragments of soul. Steele had total control from the beginning. Of course, most such constructions quickly died. The pups had to be parted from their wet nurses before they began to participate in the adult's consciousness. The resulting pack was taught entirely in speech and written language. All inputs could be controlled. Steele stopped before door number 33. Experiment Omdaranafani, Mathematical Excellence. It was not the only attempt in this direction, but it was by far the most successful. Steele's agents had searched the movement for packs with ability for abstraction. They had gone further. The world's most famous mathematician lived in the Long Lakes Republic. The pack had been preparing to fission. She had several puppies by herself and a mathematically talented lover. Steele had had the pups taken. They matched his other acquisitions so well that he decided to make an eightsome. If things worked out, it might be beyond all nature in its intelligence. Steele motioned his guard to shield the torches. He opened door 33 and soft-toed one member to the edge of the balcony. He looked down, carefully silencing that member's 4 tympanum. The skylight was dim, but he could see the pups huddled together with its new friend. The mantis, serendipity, that was all he could call this, the reward that comes to a researcher who labors long enough, carefully enough. He had had 2 problems. The first had been growing for a year. Omdaranafani was slowly fading, its members falling into the usual autism of wholly newborn packs. The second was the captured alien. That was an enormous threat, an enormous mystery, an enormous opportunity. how to communicate with it. Without communication, the possibilities for manipulation were very limited. Yet in a single blind stroke, an incompetent servant had shown the way to solve both problems. Now that his eyes were adjusted to the dimness, Steele could see the alien beneath the pile of puppies. When first he'd heard that the creature had been put in with an experiment, Steele had been enraged beyond thought. The servant who made the mistake had been recycled. But the days passed. Experiment Amdaranafani began showing more liveliness than at any time since its pups were weaned. It quickly became obvious, from dissecting the other aliens and observing this one, that mantis folk did not live in packs. Steele had a complete alien. The alien moved in its sleep and made a low-pitched mouth noise. It was totally incapable of any other kind of sound. The pups shifted to fit the new position. They were sleeping too, vaguely thinking among themselves. The low end of their sounds was a perfect imitation of the alien. And that was the greatest coup of all. Experiment Amdaranafani was learning the alien speech. To the pack of newborns, this was simply another form of inter-pack talk, and apparently its mantis friend was more interesting than the tutors who appeared on these balconies. The Flenser fragment claimed it was the physical contact, that the pups were reacting to the alien as a surrogate parent, thoughtless though the alien was. It really didn't matter. Steele brought another head to the edge of the balcony. He stood quietly, neither member thinking directly at the other. The air smelled faintly of puppies and mantis sweat. These two were the movement's greatest treasure, the key to survival and more. By now, Steele knew the flying ship was not part of an invasion fleet. Their visitors were more like ill-prepared refugees. There had been no word of other landings, and the movement's spies were spread far. It had been a close thing, winning against the aliens. Their single weapon had killed most of a regiment. In the proper jaws, such weapons could defeat armies. He had no doubt the ship contained more powerful killing machines, ones that still functioned. Wait and watch, Steele counseled himself. Let Amdaranafani show the levers that could control this alien. The entire world would be the prize. Chapter 14. Sometimes Mom used to say that something was more fun than a barrel full of puppies. Jeffrey Alshendott had never had more than one pet at a time, and only once had that been a dog, but now he understood what she meant. From the very first day, even when he had been so tired and scared, he had been entranced by the eight puppies, and they by him. They were all over him, pulling at his clothes, unfastening his shoes, sitting on his lap, or just running around him. Three or four were always staring at him. Their eyes were completely brown or pink, and seemed large for their heads. From the beginning, the puppies had mimicked him. They were better than Stroumly songbirds. Anything he said, they could echo, or play back later. And when he cried, often the puppies would cry too and cuddle around him. There were other dogs, big ones that wore clothes and entered the room through doorways high up on the walls. They lowered food into the room and sometimes made strange noises. But the food tasted awful, and they didn't respond to Jeffrey's screaming even by mimicking him. 2 days had passed, then a week. Jeffrey had investigated everything in the room. It wasn't really a dungeon. It was too big. And besides, prisoners don't get pets. He understood that this world was uncivilized, not part of the realm, perhaps not even on the net. If Mom or Dad or Johanna weren't nearby, it was possible that there was no one here to teach the dogs to speak Somnorsh. Then it would be up to Jeffrey Alshendott to teach the dogs and find his family. Now, when the white-jacketed dogs came onto the corner balconies, Jeffrey shouted questions at them. It didn't help very much. Even the one with red stripes didn't respond. But the puppies did. They shouted right along with Jeffrey, sometimes echoing his words, sometimes making nonsense sounds. It didn't take Jeffrey long to realize that the puppies were driven by a single mind, When they ran around him, some would always sit a little way off, their graceful necks arching this way and that, and the runners seemed to know exactly what the others saw. He couldn't hide things behind his back if there was even one of them to alert the others. For a while, he thought they were somehow talking to each other, but it was more than that. When he watched them unfasten his shoes or draw a picture, the heads and mouths and paws cooperated so perfectly, like the fingers on a person's hands. Jeffrey didn't reason things out so explicitly, but over a period of days he came to think of all the puppies together as a single friend. At the same time, he noticed that the puppies was mixing up his words and sometimes making new meanings. "You me play." The words came out like a cheap voice splice, but they generally preceded a mad game of tag all around the furniture. "You me picture." The slate board covered the lowest meter of the wall, all around the room. It was a display device unlike any Jeffrey had ever seen in his life. Dirty, imprecise, imperfectly deletable, unstorable. Jeffrey loved it. His face and hands, and most of Puppy's lips, got covered with chalk stains. They drew each other and themselves. Puppies didn't draw neat pictures like Jeffrey's. Puppy's dog figures had big heads and paws, with the bodies all smudged together. When he drew Jeffrey, the hands were always big, each finger carefully drawn. Jeffrey drew his family and tried to make puppies understand. Day by day, the sunlight circled higher on the walls. Sometimes the room was dark now. At least once a day, Pax came to talk to puppies. This was one of the few things which could pull the little ones away from Jeffrey. Puppies would sit below the balcony, screeching and croaking at the adults. It was a school class. They'd lower scrolls for him to look at and retrieve ones he had marked. Jeffrey sat quietly and watched the lessons. He fidgeted, but he didn't shout at the teachers anymore. Just a little longer, and he and puppies would really be talking. Just a little longer, and puppies could find out for him where Mom and Dad and Johanna were. Sometimes terror and pain are not the best levers. Deception, when it works, is the most elegant and the least expensive manipulation of all. Once Amdiranafani was fluent in the mantis language, Steele had him explain about the tragic death of Jeffrey's parents and brood sibling. The Flenser fragment had argued against it, but Steele wanted quick and unquestioned control. Now it seemed that the fragment might have been right. At least he should have held out the hope that the brood sibling lived. Steele looked solemnly at the Amdiranafani experiment. "How can we help?" The young pack looked up trustingly.
"Jeffrey is so terribly upset about his parents and sister."
Amdiranafani was using Mata's words a lot, often unnecessarily. Sister instead of brood sibling.
"He hasn't been eating much. He doesn't want to play. It makes me very sad."
Steele kept watch on the far balcony. The Flenser fragment was there. It was not hiding, though most of its faces were out of the candlelight. So far, its insights had been extraordinary. But the fragment stare was like old times, when a mistake could mean mutilation or worse. So be it. The stakes were higher now than ever before. If fear at Steele's throats could help him succeed, he welcomed it. He looked away from the balcony and brought all his faces to an expression of tender sympathy for poor Jeffrey's plight.
"You just have to make it him understand. No one can bring his parents or sister back to life. But we know who the murderers are. We're doing everything we can to defend against them. Tell him how hard this is. Woodcarvers is an empire that has lasted hundreds of years. In a fight, we are no match for them. That's why we need all the help he can give us. We need him to teach us to use his parents' ship."
The puppy pack lowered a head.
"Yes, I'll try, but..."
The three members by Jeffrey made low-pitched grunting noises at it. The mantis sat head bowed. It held its tentacled paws across its eyes. The creature had been like this for several days, and the withdrawal was getting worse. Now it shook its head violently, made sharp noises a little higher pitched than its normal register.
Jeffrey says he doesn't understand how things work in the ship. He's just a little...
The pack searched for a translation.
He is really very young. You know, like me.
Steele nodded understandingly. It was an obvious consequence of the alien's singleton nature, but weird even so. Every one of them started out all a puppy. Every one of them was like Steele's puppy pack experiments. Parental knowledge was transmitted by the equivalent of enterpack speech. That made the creature easy to dupe, but it was a damned inconvenience now. Still, if there's anything he can help explain... More grunting from the mantis. Steele should learn that language. The sounds were easy. These pitiful creatures used their mouths to talk, like a bird or a forest slug. For now, he depended on Omdurana-Fani. For now, that was okay. The puppy pack trusted him. Another piece of serendipity. With a few of his recent experiments, Steele had tried love in place of Flenser's original terror-love combination. There had been a slim chance that it might be superior. By great good luck, Omdurana-Fani fell into the love group. Even his instructors had avoided negative reinforcement. The pack would believe anything he said, and so, Steele hoped, would the mantis. Omdurana-Fani translated.
There is something else. He has asked me about it before. Jeffrey knows how to wake the other children.
The word literally meant packs of puppies.
On the ship. You look surprised, my Lord Steele.
Even though he no longer dreamed in terror of monster minds, Steele would just as soon not have 100 more aliens running around. I hadn't realized they could be wakened so easily. But we shouldn't do it right now. We're having trouble finding food that Jeffrey can eat. That was true. The creature was an incredibly finicky eater. I don't think we could feed any more right now. More grunting. More sharp cries from Jeffrey, finally.
There is one other thing, my lord. Jeffrey thinks it may be possible to use the ship's ultra-wave to call for help from others like his parents.
The Flenser fragment jerked out of the shadows. A pair of heads looked down at the mantis while another stared meaningfully at Steele. Steele didn't react. He could be cooler than any loose pack. That's something to think about. Perhaps you and Jeffrey could talk more about it. I don't want to try it till we're sure we won't hurt the ship. That was weak. He saw the fragment twitch a muzzle in amusement. As he spoke, Omdurana-Fani was translating. Jeffrey responded almost immediately.
Oh, that's okay. He meant a special call. Jeffrey says the ship has been signaling all by itself ever since it landed.
And Steele wondered if he had ever heard a deadly threat uttered in such sweet innocence. They began letting Omdi and Jeffrey outside to play. Beforehand, Omdi was nervous about going out. He was unused to wearing clothes. His whole life, all 4 years of it, had been spent in that one big room. He read about the outside and was curious about it, yet he was also a little afraid. But the human boy seemed to want it. Every day he'd been more withdrawn, his crying softer. Mostly he was crying for his parents or sister, but sometimes he cried about being locked up so deep away. So Omdi had talked to Mr. Steele, and now they got out almost every day, at least to an inner courtyard. At first, Jeffrey just sat, not really looking around. But Omdi discovered that he loved the outdoors, and each time he got his friend to play a little more. Packs of teachers and guards stood at the corners of the yellowing moss and watched. Omdi, and eventually Jeffrey, got a big kick out of harassing them. They hadn't realized it down in the room where visitors came at the balconies, but most adults were nervous around Jeffrey. The boy was half again as tall as a normally standing pack member. When he came close, the average pack would clump together and edge away. They didn't like having to look up at him. It was silly, Omdi thought. Jeffrey was so tall and skinny, he looked like he might topple over at any moment. And when he ran, it was like he was wildly trying to recover from a fall and never quite succeeding.
So Omdi's favorite game those first days was tag. Whenever he was the chaser, he contrived to run Yefri right through the most prim-looking white jackets. If he and Yefri did it right, they could turn the tag into a three-way event, Omdi chasing Yefri and the white jackets racing to stay away from both of them. Sometimes he felt sorry for the guards in white jackets. They were so stiff and grown up. Didn't they understand how much fun it was to have a friend that you walk right next to, that you could actually touch? It was mostly night now. Daylight hovered for a few hours around noon. The twilight before and after was bright enough to dim the stars and aurora, but still too faint to show colors. Though Omdi had spent his life indoors, he understood the geometry of the situation and liked to watch the change of light. Yefri didn't much like the dark of winter, until the first snow fell. Omdi got his first set of jackets, and Mr. Steele had special clothes made for the human boy, big puffy things that covered his whole body and kept him warmer than a good pelt would have done. On one side of the courtyard, the snow was just 6 inches deep, but elsewhere it piled into drifts higher than Omdi's head. Torches were mounted and wind shields on the walls. Their light glittered golden off the snow. Omdi knew about snow, but he'd never seen it before. He loved to splash it on one of his jackets. He would stare and stare, trying to see the snowflakes without his breath melting them. The hexagonal pattern was tantalizing just at the limit of his vision. But tag was no fun anymore. The human could run through drifts that left Omdi swimming in the white stuff. There were other things the human could do, wonderful things. He could make balls of snow and throw them. The guards were very upset by this, especially when Yefri plinked a few members. It was the first time he ever saw them get angry. Omdi raced around the windswept side of the courtyard, dodging snowballs and keening frustration. Human hands were such wicked, wicked things. How he would love to have a pair, four pairs. He circled round from three sides and sprinted right at the human. Yefri backed quickly into deeper snow, but too late. Omdi hit him high and low, tipping the two legs over into a snowdrift. There was a mock battle, slashing lips and paws against Yefri's hands and feet. But now Omdi was on top. The human got paid back for his snowballs with plenty of snow stuffed down the back of his jacket. Sometimes they just sat and watched the sky for so long that rumps and paws went numb. Sitting behind the largest snowdrift, they were shaded from the castle torches and had a clear view of the lights in the sky. At first, Omdi had been entranced by the aurora. Even some of his teachers were. They said this part of the world was one of the best places to see the sky glow. Sometimes it was so faint that the torchlight glimmering off the snow was enough to blot it out. Other times it ran from horizon to horizon, green light trimmed with hints of pink, twisting as though ruffled by a slow wind. He and Yefri could talk very easily now, though always in Yefri's language. The human couldn't make many of the sounds of Interpak speech. Even his pronunciation of Omdi's name was scarcely recognizable. But Omdi understood Somnorsh pretty well. It was fun, their own secret language. Yefri was not especially impressed by the aurora.
"We have that lots at home. It's just light from—"
He said a new word and glanced at Omdi. It was funny how the human couldn't look in more than one place at a time. His eyes and head were always moving.
"You know, places where people make things. I think the gas and waste leaks out, and then the sun lights it up, or it gets—"
Unintelligible.
Places where people make things?
In the sky? Omdi had a globe. He knew the size of the world and its orientation. If the aurora were reflecting sunlight, it must be hundreds of miles above the ground. Omdi leaned back against Yefri's jacket and made a very human whistling sound. His knowledge of geography was not up to his geometry, but...
The packs don't work in the sky, Yefri. We don't even have flying boats.
Ah, that's right, you don't.
I don't know what that stuff is, then.
But I don't like it. It gets in the way of the stars.
Omdi knew all about the stars. Yefri had told him.
somewhere out there were the friends of Jeffrey's parents. Jeffrey was silent for several minutes. He wasn't looking at the sky anymore. Amdi wriggled a little closer, watching the shifting light in the sky. Behind them, the wind-sharpened crest of the drift was edged with yellow light from the torches. Amdi could imagine what the other was thinking. "The comm sets from the boat, they really aren't good enough to call for help?" Jeffrey slapped the ground. "No, I told you. They're just radio. I think I can make them work, but what's the use? The ultrawave stuff is still on the boat, and it's too big to move. I just don't understand why Mr. Steele won't let me go aboard. I'm 8 years old, you know. I could figure it out. Mom had it all set up before... His words guttered into the familiar, despairing silence. Amdi rubbed a head against Jeffrey's shoulder. He had a theory about Mr. Steele's reluctance. It was an explanation he hadn't told Jeffrey before. "Maybe he's afraid you'll just fly away and leave us." "That's stupid. I'd never leave you. Besides, that boat is real hard to fly. It was never meant to land on a world." Jeffrey said the strangest things. Sometimes Amdi was just misunderstanding, but sometimes they were literal truth. Did the humans really have ships that never came to ground? Where did they go then? Amdi could almost feel new scales of reference clicking together in his mind. Mr. Steele's geography globe represented not the world, but something very, very small in the true scheme of things. "I know you wouldn't leave us, but you can see how Mr. Steele might be afraid. He can't even talk to you except through me. We have to show him that we can be trusted." "I guess. If you and I could get the radios working, that might help. I know my teachers haven't figured them out. Mr. Steele has one, but I don't think he understands it either." "Yeah, if we could get the other one to work."
That afternoon, the guards got a break. Their two charges came in from the cold early. The guards didn't question their good fortune. End of Side 4. Chainside Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.